Good morning, everyone.
So we are going to read the Bible now, and it's a very easy reading to find because it's the very beginning of the Bible, Genesis 1. I'm going to be starting a sort of series on the first part of Genesis. I'll be starting it today, so we'll be looking at that over the coming months. Probably Genesis is my favorite book of the Bible, probably, if I have a favorite. And I actually found it really difficult because there's so much I would like to say about it. There's so much I could say. I've read so much about Genesis. And it's been quite challenging this week because I didn't want this to turn into a sort of college lecture. So I've left out so much that I could talk about. And I'll probably find that every week when I'm preaching on Genesis because I love it so much. But we're going to be spending this week and we'll do another... I'll do another sermon on Genesis 1 as well. And I just wanted to focus in on really, I think, what's most important. So let's read this chapter. So it's the first chapter in the Bible. It's a fairly long reading today. So Genesis chapter 1. And this is where the Bible, our Bible begins. And it lays foundations for how we should see things. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the expanse and separated the water above the expanse from the water above it. Sorry, the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky." So God created the creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the waters teem, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. So, Genesis, I love this book. And as I say, there's so much in this first chapter of Genesis that could be said. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say a few things today, just brief things overall about what I think, the difference I think this chapter made in the ancient world. Next week, it's all age. So I thought next week we're going to just celebrate some of the glory of this creation. You know, like that video we saw, that clip. I mean, I can't watch something like that without just being blown away. You know, what you could see on the edge from the surface of the sun, just incredible. So next week with the children, I think we'll just celebrate some of the glory of God's creation and just to stop to appreciate the goodness of what God has made. And then I'll do one more sermon on Genesis 1, which will focus on us and the little bit at the end of this chapter that talks about human beings. Okay, so Genesis 1. Now, pretty much all ancient cultures in biblical times had creation stories of their own. They are, in fact, one of, if not the most common form of ancient story tradition, creation stories. And many of them have survived with us to this day. Creation stories were sometimes quite strange, but they are always fascinating when you look at them, because these stories in the ancient world were attempting to explain how the world functions, how life works. The point was not so much what happened, that's more of a modern question, but rather it was about how things function. So how do things fit together and work in terms of us, the place we live in, the things that we depend on day to day, and how do the God or gods that you believe in fit into that? So some creation stories in the ancient world were quite fantastical tales, but all of them conveyed some sort of idea, a proposed truth about how life works. Now, I think it is important, I think, to recognize that that's what they were about, because a lot of time and energy has been spent over the last, 50, 60 years or so, arguing about Genesis or science and which version of Origins is true. Now, you may disagree with me on this, but personally, I think it's a complete waste of time because it's missing the point. Even worse, I worry it can distract people from thinking about Jesus. In my opinion, arguing about whether sort of Genesis or science is true is a bit like arguing over whether oranges or chairs are better. They're two completely different things. So if you need to sit down, you want a chair. If you want orange juice, you'll need an orange. Science is asking a way of asking one type of question. Ancient creation stories, like this one in Genesis, they were a way of asking very different kinds of question. The point of creation stories was not so much here is what happened, it was much more here is how things fit in place and work. Now, when ancient Israel came out of slavery, they left Egypt, one culture, and they headed to a new home in Canaan, another culture. Where they were going to be surrounded when they'd settled in Canaan, they would then be surrounded by yet more different cultures, all of whom had their stories of how the world works. So it was no surprise that God gave Israel its own creation story to tell them how they should properly understand things. The Israelites, we know, had spent centuries living in Egypt. And if you spend centuries in any culture, you will end up seeing things how that culture sees them. They were headed to the culture of the Canaanites, The Canaanites had their own worldviews, their own stories and answers to the big questions. The Israelites may well, in fact they did, become somewhat influenced by those Canaanite traditions when they settled. And the ancient Israel's new neighbors were going to be the Mesopotamians. You know, later on the Assyrians would come along, the Babylonians, of course. All of them had their own stories. Now, we know this because we still have many of these creation stories from the ancient world. They were recorded on hieroglyphs in Egypt. They're on stone reliefs and stone engravings from Mesopotamia and other cultures. So we actually know a lot about how different cultures in biblical times told stories about how the world is. The Genesis story is important. It was important for Israel because within that melting pot of ideas, it gave the Israelites a proper understanding of who God really is and what he is really like and who we really are and how it all fits together and functions. Now, we today are still surrounded by different ideas of how life works, about who we are, different ideas and stories, shall we say, about who we are as human beings, about what this planet is for, about what the purpose is of it all, about if there are any God or gods and how those God or gods might behave and think and expect of us. All sorts of different ideas surround us still today. And the principles given us here in Genesis 1, I think, are therefore still really important for us. They are our starting point as Christians. Now, this chapter, Genesis 1, it is beautifully written. The Hebrew is exquisite. Genesis 1 is as much a poem as it is a story. In some ways, it bears some similarities to the other creation stories from the ancient Near East at a similar time. That shouldn't surprise us. The Bible does reflect the time at which it was written. So, for example, order coming out of disorder or chaos, the origin of things out of a sort of primordial water, the emergence of land from the water, the shape of the sky described as a sort of dome over the earth in which lights are then placed, the presence of waters further up above the dome of the sky. Those were all very common assumptions about things in the ancient world. But I think perhaps more significant than that, there is a focus in this chapter on the topics of time and seasons, day and night, weather, crops, reproduction. Those were the most important questions for everyone in the ancient world. Would the change in seasons come? Would the weather therefore turn, you know, the sunshine, the rains fall, meaning would the crops grow? Would the flocks multiply? Would the babies be born? In other words, were things functioning in some sort of understandable way so that we can depend on what we need to live? Those concerns are common to pretty much all ancient creation stories, including Genesis, because those were the things people worried about most. But in other ways, the Genesis story is very different to all the others. And this is where I think it's so important and still so relevant. In fact, this is where I think Genesis stands out in all the versions of how things are. Genesis stands out and gives us our unique worldview as Christians today. Genesis was unique in the way it described God, and it was unique in the way it described human beings, and therefore unique in how it described that relationship between God and us and the day-to-day things of life. Now, firstly, Genesis 1 tells us there is one God without rivals. Now, that might not sound like a big deal today. You know, we've had millennia of monotheism that says there's only one God. It sounds ordinary. It was a huge deal in the ancient world when Genesis was first told and written. Everyone in the ancient world assumed there were lots of different gods, polytheism, and each of the gods had different characteristics, and each god or goddess was in control of a different aspect of life that we depend on. So you had to give the god of weather the attention that he or she wanted so that the weather would go right. And these are, we meet these in ideas in the Bible, you know, people like Baal. Baal was like a storm god, a god of weather. So the Israelites were rubbing shoulders with cultures who believed there were all these different gods that looked after different areas of life. So you had to give what the weather god wanted so that the weather would go right. You would then give the god or goddess of war the things that they wanted so that battles would go your way. There was a god of crops, a god of fertility. There would be a god of sea and a god of sky. There were quite commonly people worship the sun as a god and the moon as a god. Interestingly, that's probably why Genesis refuses to name the sun and the moon. There are Hebrew words for sun and moon. Genesis 1 deliberately doesn't use them because they were commonly seen as gods. Genesis just says, no, they're just some lights that God has put there. There was a god of death. You know, attention had to be given to that god when one of your relatives died and you wanted the afterlife to go well. So that was what everyone assumed. There are just all these gods and you've got to rush around giving the right thing to the right one, depending on what you need at this point. Pretty stressful idea when you think about it. You were running around trying to please all these different gods so that things went okay, and you had to give them a heck of a lot of stuff. Sometimes quite extreme offerings that were given to these gods. But more than just that, the gods of the ancient world that Israel would have heard about from the other cultures, they were not loving gods. They didn't really particularly care about human life. They cared about their own lives. The gods could be capricious, disinterested. They could be quite selfish, nasty, and devious. They got annoyed and grumpy, and they changed their minds a lot. So you had to do all sorts of things, it was believed, to try and keep the gods happy, keep them on your side, make it worth their while sending you the good fortune that you wanted instead of the misfortune that you didn't. But into that world and those assumptions, the God of Israel comes along and he gives them the Genesis story, in which it's just him. There are no rivals to him. There's no competition for attention. And even more importantly, God actually loves the world that he's created, and he cares about it. The first descriptor of God's character in the Bible, because it's in verse 2, is a word that was also used to describe a mother bird who's brooding over the young that she is caring for and raising in her nest. She's feeding them, she's nurturing them, she's protecting them. That's the word used of God's spirit hovering over the earth in verse 2. And throughout this chapter, God just keeps giving and giving and giving, never demanding anything first, never on condition. It says he creates, he blesses, he makes fruitful and provides. God is always in this chapter taking the initiative to do what is very good and to bless and provide for what he has made. The words, he blessed them, he provided, he saw that he looked at the world and said, it's really good. That would have stood out in the ancient world as quite shocking, that God actually wants to bless us without us having to persuade him to. And to hear of a God who looks at the world and says, it is good, even more that he looks after we've been made, human beings, and says, it's very good, that was revolutionary. This is telling us that the God of this universe is not in doubt, okay? He's not at risk in his position, and he is good, he is benevolent and loving by nature. And that makes a huge difference to life. Job 38, we hear God saying this: where were you when I laid the earth's foundation, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Creation was a thing of joy. Psalm 65, you care for the land and water it, you enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with corn, for so you have ordained it. You drench its furrows and level its ridges. You soften it with showers and bless its crops. You crown the year with your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the wilderness will overflow. The hills are clothed with gladness. The meadows covered with flocks. The valleys are mantled with corn. They shout for joy and sing. This was unheard of in the ancient world, this idea that actually God and earth is singing for joy. It means something for us in our lives. We have not got to do all sorts of extreme, exhausting things to persuade God to notice us and like us. Genesis says that was all nonsense, because there is one God over everything who loves us and wants to bless us. Now, we get in the way of that, you know, a bit like the eclipse. And Genesis gets to that when we get to chapter 3. But it begins by assuring us, you know, when there are problems, it doesn't come from God. God's intention is good. Do you ever feel like, I don't know, I've had this feeling sometimes, you almost feel like life is against you. Or it's in the balance, you know, a sort of to and fro between good luck and bad luck, fortune and misfortune. I know we don't talk about luck and things like that as Christians, but sometimes we begin to feel like that, oh, something's got it in for me. Although we live in a scientific age today and we base a lot on logic and reason, I think a lot of us still at times think in quite superstitious ways about things, almost as if the old gods are still in our minds and life is on tenterhooks and someone's got it in for us. And now I know that when life deals difficulties to you, when life is tough, it really can feel like that at times. As I say, I felt like that, like something or someone's got it in for me. But the very first chapter in the Bible tells us that's not how life works, okay? It might feel like that at times, but we must not let that feeling reflect on how we see God. Because God is not, Genesis is saying, God is not like those old gods that the others believed in. He is good, and no one else or nothing else is going to change that. There's not some rival trying to change God's mind. Meaning, you can absolutely depend on God. You can trust God 100% of the time without any fear that God is somehow going to be pushed out of the picture or persuaded not to care or get grumpy with you or change his mind because he hasn't got what he wants, because that's what the other gods were like. But Genesis says that there is actually only one God and he's not like that at all. So if there's one thing this chapter tells us about God at the very beginning of the Bible, the first description of God in the Bible, therefore the first thing we need to know about God is that God is for us, not against us. He is for us, not against us. The New Testament tells us that and assures us of that because of Jesus. The Bible doesn't start with what's gone wrong. It doesn't start with our sin and our struggle. It will talk about that later. We will get there. But it begins, first of all, with God described as a God of goodness, who is overjoyed at the sight of the world that he creates and is doing everything to bless us. That's where we begin. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his son. So the God of Genesis that we believe in, it was very different to the gods of Egypt, Canaan, Mesopotamia, Babylon, blah, blah, blah. But the other big difference I want to talk about today in Genesis is the place of human beings. That too was very different to what other creation stories said. Now, in many of the other stories in the ancient world, human beings were either a nuisance to the gods, or they were just slaves of the gods, or just a kind of afterthought, certainly not important to them. That's why in the ancient world, people thought they literally had to grovel and persuade the gods, sometimes by harming themselves and offering the most awful offerings. They believed in the ancient world, you had to do that for the gods to actually even notice you, let alone send any good your way. Because the gods ultimately, for most people, thought very little of human beings. They were more interested in themselves. But in Genesis 1, the creation of human beings is the bit that God loves best about his creation. The creation of human beings in this chapter is like the ultimate pinnacle of the creation story. The best bit in the universe. I know we might look at ourselves and think, really? But God actually says that He says, actually, of all these incredible things we see around us, when he looks at people, that's when he says it's not just good, it's very good what he has made. It is human beings, we're told in this chapter, who, unlike anything else, we are actually made in God's image. We are made in a way that can reflect God more than anything else in the universe. It is human beings who God puts in charge of things, of looking after the world, of gives them dominion to rule, which means to look after and keep the world. He gives that responsibility to us. And it is human beings he spends the longest amount of time, especially blessing in this chapter. Now, we will say a bit more about human beings, because it goes into chapter 2 as well. We'll do that another time. But I wanted us just today to get this sense of what made, you know, what was it that made Genesis stand out as different in the ancient world when it was written? And I hope it stands out for this still today. The Bible begins by laying a foundation for us to understand things. And it begins with a very positive view of God and of the world and even of us. As I say, we'll get to the pretty naff stuff about us in a bit, but it begins with positive. And really, that should be the starting point, I think, of all our theology. Even when we think about the more difficult stuff, our sin and death and suffering, Genesis says, before you get to that, start here. Start with the knowledge that the universe exists by the generosity of God's grace. And he's the one God. There's no one else trying to take his place there. He created it all to be a blessing. And this God has an especially big place in his heart for us, believe it or not, the human being, the human race. Start there, Genesis says. Start there because that will take all the rest of your theology in the right direction. If you keep that in mind, our view of God's character, our view of human worth, our view of how we treat the earth and each other will all be shaped in the right direction if we begin here with the goodness of creation. Just as an example of the impact this has, this, I think, if you could argue in the history of human thought, this chapter is the foundation of where the Christian view of the equal worth and dignity of all human beings comes from. That, you know, we just take that for granted nowadays. So, well, of course, everyone, all human beings, equal worth and dignity. For the majority of history, that was not assumed by people. Okay, where did it come from? It comes as a Christian understanding of our human worth. It begins in a passage like Genesis 1. And start there in your life too, for yourself. Because starting with Genesis 1 will assure you, you will have a right understanding of how God feels about you. And about how you should see yourself, therefore, and your relationship with God. God is good, he loves you. And your life means a huge amount to him. You are not an afterthought, like some people thought in the ancient world. You're not a nuisance. You're not just a chess piece for the gods to play their games. God is not a big angry man in the sky who may or may not be in a good mood with you today, depending on whether you've given him what he wanted. That's what other stories in biblical times said. And Genesis says that is not how it is. The world is not meaningless. It was created for blessing. Your relationship with God need not be stressful like the old pagan religions were. Your relationship with God can be more like listening to and learning from a parent who loves you and respecting and trusting and relying on God because he loves you. Remember that first description of God's character in this chapter, like a mother bird brooding over her young. And this is still true today because the New Testament tells us it's still true. It takes the words from this chapter and uses those words to describe what God was doing when he sent his son, Jesus, into the world. Genesis 1 says, in the beginning, God created. John chapter 1 in the New Testament begins, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. Through him, all things were made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. That's all Genesis language, and John says, and the Word, who is Jesus, has become flesh now, and he's dwelt among us. The same God who created in Genesis 1 is doing new creation through Jesus today. 2 Corinthians 4 says, for God who said, let light shine out of darkness, that's Genesis, has now made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of his glory, which we see in the face of Christ. Psalm 8, we read earlier, looks at creation. When I consider your heavens, the work of your hands, the moon, the stars, what you've set in place, it's all so incredible. What is mankind? What are we that you're so mindful of us, that you care so much for us? You made us a little lower than the heavenly beings, but you've crowned us with glory and honor. So the psalmist there said, the universe is incredible, vast, glorious, and yet God has given so much blessing and grace to us human beings. Well, the New Testament takes that psalm up in Hebrews 2, and these words are then spoken of Jesus. Hebrews 2 quotes Psalm 8, but then it says, and now we see Jesus, who was made himself a little lower than the angels. In other words, he was made human. But he is now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God, Jesus might taste death for everyone. The same God who brought us life in the first place has sent his son Jesus to be one of us and to overcome the death that would take away God's life from us. So the point is, God is still the God of Genesis 1 who does all things to bring us life and salvation, and he's still doing it today through Jesus.